Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune, heard statewide on Utah Public Radio. I'm your host, Roger McDonough. Today on the program, a proposal to replace Utah's voter passed Medicaid expansion gets fast-tracked at the state legislature. Governor Gary Herbert and House Speaker Brad Wilson want to deliver the largest tax cut in state history, but Democrats call for investments in other policy priorities, and a judge rules that a San Juan County commissioner is indeed a Utahn. Joining me for this conversation, we've got Salt Lake Tribune reporter Brian Maffley, and welcome. Thanks for being here,
yeah,
Brian.
Thanks, Roger. Yeah.
Also, reporter Benjamin Wood. Good morning to you, Ben, and welcome.
Good morning.
And news columnist Robert Gerke. Thanks for being here, Robert.
Thank you. Good morning.
And you are invited to join this conversation as well. Post your questions and comments at sltrib.com or call us at 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK. Ben Wood, so far it feels like the big story out of the legislative session has to do with Medicaid. Lawmakers are trying to replace what voters passed in Proposition 3, which enacts full Medicaid expansion here in Utah. There's a bill that is very quickly making its way through the legislature that would change that. What is this proposal, Ben, and how does it differ from what full Medicaid expansion that passed under this initiative, Proposition 3, does?
Yeah, and to talk about the differences, I mean, to try and keep it high level, under full Medicaid expansion, if you're earning up to 138% of poverty, you are covered by Medicaid. Under this bill, only up to 100% of poverty is covered in Medicaid. The remaining population would be put on the individual insurance marketplace for the Affordable Care Act. So it's a difference between having access to health care versus access to health insurance.
How about in terms of money that the state needs to spend to get it covered? To actually take it?
Well, that's a complicated question because initially the legislative plan will cost more. The state will be paying three times as much than they otherwise would be to cover the same population of people. Now, the expectation or the hope is that the federal government will, down the road, agree to cover 90% of costs. They say they've been given assurances. CMS will not confirm or deny those assurances, and no other state has a deal like this.
This is the Center for Medicaid and
Medicaid and Medicare Services.
Services, thank you. Yeah, we need a waiver from the federal government for this proposal to go into effect.
Right, because this proposal does not comply with the Affordable Care Act. So in order to do that, you have to have permission from the federal government to break the law.
That's not something that we've been able to do, though, so far. I mean, you said that that they have assurances from CMS. Who are the they in that conversation?
The they is mostly Senator Alan Christensen, North Ogden Republican. He said that he's been all but guaranteed that the waiver will go through, and that's his word is all that we have on that subject. Because like I said, I've reached out to CMS. They would not comment.
Why do Senator Christensen and other lawmakers say that Proposition 3 needs replacing, that we have to have a different proposal?
Well, the cost is a big issue. They cite the cost, but again, there's a lot of unknowns there. In fact, we're still waiting for the fiscal analysis of the bill that the senator is proposing. For at least Senator Christensen, he has stated he is philosophically opposed to expanding Medicaid. He doesn't think it's a good thing to do. So for him, that's one of his motivations. I suspect that's a motivation for many of his colleagues.
That's one of the motivations. But as you pointed out, cost is the one that they're citing sort of publicly, although Senator Christensen has said that he is in public that he is philosophically opposed to it. But at the same time, he says he's running this because costs will get out of hand. Is it hard for us to get a handle on what the cost will be to the state of Utah? I mean, to the actual cost of the state of Utah will be for Proposition 3?
Yeah, of course. We don't know who will enroll. We don't know how many will enroll. We don't know what ails the people who will enroll. And one of the interesting quirks about this bill, and one that's been hard to describe, is that it relies on something called per capita caps, where instead of this, we pay a dollar, they pay nine situation, the federal government say, here's money to use, and if our population gets inordinately sick, then Utah would have to pay all of the costs above what the federal government gave us.
I mean, it's basically a block grant that the state wants, and again, as Ben pointed out, it's something that no other state's received yet.
This is Robert Gerke talking.
And you can probably bet that if Utah does get it, you're going to have 36 other states lining up to get the same deal, because they would like to have 90-10 without the cost on their end. So, yeah, it's striking that Dunnigan and Christensen, Representative Jim Dunnigan of Taylorsville, is the House sponsor of this bill. Dunnigan and Christensen have said that they've been all but assured that they're going to get this. And if they do, it would be a really remarkable shift, I guess, for HHS to grant that kind of waiver.
Is if we don't get that waiver, do we just revert to Prop 3? We don't have Medicaid expansion in the state of Utah. Is that right?
Well, and if we don't get that waiver, then the state will have taken on that triple cost structure in perpetuity. So, like I said, initially this will cost more, and everyone kind of agrees on that. The state will be paying more to cover this population. If that waiver never arrives, then that 30% share the state has taken on will just keep on going, and we'll be paying three times as much than we otherwise would be.
I want the sort of simple language version of the story. Under Prop 3, the state has to pay, you know, how much money to cover how many people versus what Senator Christensen is proposing.
According to the governor's Office of Management and Budget, they've estimated about $100 million to cover 128,000 newly eligible people.
That's under Prop 3.
Under Prop 3. And on top of that, they're expecting about 20,000 people who are currently eligible to receive Medicaid benefits but have not enrolled just because they haven't. You know, they don't want to fill out the paperwork or go through the bureaucracy or whatever. And so, you know, there's a sales tax that was included in Prop 3 that pays for the bulk of that. One of the things that Christensen's bill does is it brings back in a hospital tax, which was included in a bill that Robert Spendlove passed last year, that brings in about $15 million. That's something that was, I guess, inadvertently written out of Prop 3, because hospitals have said hospitals are a big beneficiary if Medicaid goes through, because right now they have uncompensated care where they provide care to people that come into emergency rooms and they don't see a dime from it. And so they end up having to eat those costs or, frankly, pass it on to you and I when we go to the hospital. So they would be big beneficiaries from that because they wouldn't have any more uncompensated care. So the idea is that part of that they receive would then be used to pay for the coverage. Bringing that back in makes a lot of sense. There's one other little tweak about a cost of living adjustment for providers that can be interpreted to mean big increases for doctors year after year after year, and that quickly becomes unsustainable. So they would fix that in Christensen's bill too. Both of those things need to be fixed. Representative Ray Ward in the House has a bill that just fixes that, leaves the rest of it in place. And Senator Escamilla had a substitute bill that she proposed when it was up in the Senate, and it was voted down. So this seems to be the direction they're going. As Ben reported yesterday, I believe they want to have this at the governor's desk by end of next week.
Why the rush? I mean, maybe that's a question for Ben. Why the rush?
The answer they're giving is that because we'd have to request these waivers, the sooner we can request, the sooner we get the waiver, which means we have to have a bill, a law on the books in order to start that application process.
We started that simple language process of doing the $128,000 that the state would be on the hook for, but that would be paid for by a tax that's included in Proposition 3. And then we didn't get to the how much SB 96 would cost the state.
Well, they haven't. So Senator Christensen had said that he had hoped to have the fiscal note, the scoring from the fiscal analyst's office by the end of yesterday, I believe, or the end of the day before, actually, I think.
Right, they're hoping to have it before they voted yesterday.
And so they didn't get it, so they put off the vote. Here's what I think is holding this up is when they're talking about a 70-30 split, when the state's paying 30 cents on the dollar as opposed to paying 10 cents on the dollar, that score is not going to look good when they get it because it's going to cost three times as much to cover the same number of people that you would get, that you would cover under Prop 3. So while they're making this argument that we need to pass SB 96 to maintain this fiscal stability and solvency, the score that they're going to get is going to look like they're going to be spending way more money to cover a smaller number of people.
So and that proposal is, again, the 70-30 split. Lawmakers hope to then get a 90-10 split for covering that fewer number of people, but they may never get it, correct?
Right, and that is what was passed last year, and which the state was waiting months to get approval for, and they never did get. We had a vote while that application was still in process, and it was superseded. I mean, essentially, what SB 96 does is it reverts back to the law that was on the books last March, as if the vote over Prop 3 never took place.
And it's kind of interesting. Yeah, what Ben said is exactly right, that the that this takes us back to Spendlove's, this bill passed by Representative Robert Spendlove last year. So you can kind of get a sense of how much it would cost. And you know, we're talking about a total of about $500 million. But, you know, when we're talking about state funds specifically, I'm looking at it right now.
Sure,
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
But it's about $13 million, it looks like, in state funds to bring in that federal funding.
Will, I guess, Robert Gerke, you're a columnist and you've got opinions. Do you think it'll be smooth sailing for SB 96 all the way through to the governor's desk and past the governor's desk?
Yes. You know, I mean, leadership has said that they're going to pass this bill. The Republicans on the first vote in the Senate all, you know, lined up the way they expected, except for Senator Todd Weiler, I think, broke ranks and made the case that his voters voted for Prop 3, so he was going to back his constituents on that. And I don't anticipate you'll get anything different in the House. And the governor said last week, I believe, that it's something. And as Ben pointed out, if this takes us back to the bill the governor already signed after last session, it's a safe bet that he's going to sign it again. And frankly, it's not just similar to what Robert Spendlove proposed last session. It's something that's very similar to what Governor Gary Herbert proposed in 2014 and 2015 with his Healthy Utah plan. And so, you know, you could make the case with the exception of the caps. That's the notable exception, is that the governor's proposal did not have caps on it. But you could make the case that, you know, the governor comes out a winner in this because he ultimately gets what he was proposing in the first place. And the loser really is those Utahns, those low-income Utahns who spent the last 4 years who could have had coverage over that period of time had the legislature been willing to pass the governor's bill or the bill that he proposed, the Healthy Utah package.
Hmm. Ultimately, are we covering fewer people for more money? I mean, with SB 96, is there a short answer to that, or is there not?
It would cover, yes. That's essentially what it would do, because it keeps that 100 to 138% of poverty population on private insurance. And so we're covering about 90,000 people in SB 96, as opposed to about 130,000 people in under Prop 3. You know, the case that Representative Dunnigan makes is that those people get subsidies under the ACA to buy this private insurance. And so because they are fairly low, you know, we're talking about people that are making between $12,000 and $16,000 a year, individuals. And so that's not a ton of money, but they do get fairly hefty subsidies to buy this insurance on the private market. Dunnigan says they can get a platinum package for anywhere between $25 and $30
a month, right, Gerke?
Yes, $25 to $30 a month. So, but you know, when you're talking about somebody who's making just over $12,000, $30 a month can add up pretty quick.
And that's an insurance plan, and anyone who's on insurance knows that that's not the only cost you pay.
Right. Right. Is the, I guess, you know, so it's smooth sailing for this bill all the way through to the governor's desk, and then, you know, we'll see what happens after that. And this is kind of in the pursuit of fiscal responsibility, and that's because of the influx that lawmakers think will happen as a result of the passage of a full Medicaid expansion and the cost that will come to the state as a result of that. I hope I'm summing that up correctly.
Yeah, I mean, the numbers that the governor's office provided last month did suggest that under Prop 3, that the sales tax increase would not cover the expenses that would be incurred by covering the entire population. And so that's why the legislature is saying we need to do this. And there's some merit to the argument that when you're providing social services like Medicaid, it's the costs are at the lowest when the economy is the best. Right now, we've got very low unemployment. You know, a lot of people are working, and so the costs are going to be at their lowest right now. What happened with a recession, for example, the last recession, as the economy tanks, state tax revenues go way down, and the population that needs coverage, that needs assistance, goes way up. And so your costs go up right as your revenues go down, and that leaves them in a bind. And so that's why they want the caps on it, to sort of hedge against the future downturn.
I mean, it sounds like we're worried about the cost of helping people when they get poorer, or when there are more of them to help.
Yeah.
Which is It's interesting. I mean, the idea is that if there are more people to help, we want to help fewer of them. Is that
well? They don't want to be put in a position where, you know, say 3 years down the road, we hit another recession, and they have to make the decision of either rescinding benefits from people who've had them in the past, denying benefits for people who are applying them for them currently, or cutting other areas, cutting roads or schools or public safety to try to make sure that they are able to provide the benefits that they've committed to providing. So, you know, there's some logic behind the, you know, sure, the thinking that we need to be able to pay for this long term. I'm not convinced based on, you know, because as Ben pointed out at the beginning, they've been they've not been forthcoming with any of the numbers for the plan they're proposing. And it hinges entirely on this waiver that's never been granted, that I'm not entirely convinced that what they're proposing is any more fiscally sustainable than what is in Prop 3.
Ben, just on that waiver, as we head to a break, and then we'll come back and talk more about fiscal responsibility and tax cuts. But the supporters of this bill say that it's a new day in Washington. We have a different administration. We have people, well, a different sort of mindset in Washington that will allow this waiver, but you can't get comment on that, right? I mean, this is what you've said about CMS not responding.
Well, not only can we not get comment on that, but waivers are subject to the whims of whoever's in the White House at the current time. You know, we saw this with education a lot, where from the transition from Barack Obama to Donald Trump, a lot of waivers that were previously available were no longer available. So, I mean, yeah, right now they are told that they have a favorable administration that will grant these waivers. We have an election in 2 years, and the law will probably outlast that.
Okay. Well, we will talk more about this, I'm sure, as the session progresses and see how quickly SB 96 makes its way through the legislature. We need to take a quick break on the show. There's more to come from this past week's news. Stay tuned. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW. For more episodes of all our in-house podcasts, click on the Local Programs tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to KCPW to support public radio in your community.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW, and I'm joined this hour by Salt Lake Tribune reporters Benjamin Wood and Brian Maffley, as well as news columnist Robert Gerke. You can join us with your questions and comments by calling 801-355-8255. Or posting your questions at sltrib.com. Ben Wood, we were talking a little bit about Medicaid expansion, or a lot about Medicaid expansion before the break, and then the topic of fiscal responsibility came up, which kind of brings us to another topic. The state has a $1 billion surplus to play around with, I guess. And so there have been some suggestions of big tax cuts in Utah. What kind of tax cuts are we talking about here, Ben?
We're talking about in the neighborhood of $225 million combined.
And who's making these proposals?
Well, so it started with the governor saying 200, and then Speaker Wilson said, "I see you, I raise you 225." They seem to have settled on this 225 number with all their chips on the table, and now they're just starting the process of actually looking at what a package might look like. So there's this big number floating out there, and yet we have very few specifics about exactly how that would happen. The likeliest scenario would be some sort of cut to the income tax rate combined with a broadening of the sales tax base, or applying the sales tax to more transactions.
Okay. And that broadening of the sales tax to more transactions, what does that generally mean? What are we talking about when we say broadening the sales tax to a wider range of transactions?
Right. So this has been kind of the cause célèbre of the session so far, where we're reminded every day that fewer and fewer of the things that Utahns spend their money on are captured by the sales tax. So some of the examples that have been given, Senator Adams says, "We used to buy lawnmowers, sales tax. Now we pay people to mow our lawns, no sales tax." Or Governor Herbert's example is, "We used to buy buggy whips, sales tax. Now we take an Uber or Lyft, no sales tax." And there's a bit of a caveat there, but still. So the idea is that we're spending more of our money on these services that do not fall under traditional sales. And so fewer and fewer of the things we're spending our money on are generating revenue for the state.
I mean, so the sales tax, not the sales tax, the tax cut isn't predicted to come just from the $1 billion surplus. It would be part of a plan that pays for itself, essentially.
Yeah, I mean, and we could fall really far down a rabbit hole here,
right,
but all of that surplus, essentially, is from the income tax side. So at the same time that we're talking about reforming the sales tax, there's no money there to cut, really. And so the cut would have to come from the income tax side, because that's where all the money is right now.
Hmm. There are rumors that, you know, winter is coming, that we're in for a recession. Does that play into whether or not, or how or if this this tax cut will happen? I mean, are lawmakers thinking about that? Is this, I guess this might be a question for Gerke. Like, is this something that is likely to pass, a sales, a tax reform package?
I think maybe it could be a hedge against the recession. The sales tax is generally seen as a pretty stable tax. But I think this is something that they've needed to do. This sort of fundamental tax restructuring is something they've needed to do for years, and nobody has had sort of the political courage to do it. Because as Ben pointed out, income tax has been booming for the last several years. But under the Constitution, all of that money has to go to public and higher education. And so what they've been doing year after year after year, as the sales tax has been shrinking and diminishing more and more, is taking money out of education and using it to prop up other areas of government. And they've run out of money that they can take out of higher education right now. And so they have to figure out some way to get more money into the other areas of government. And so, you know, they tried to do a gas tax increase, and that sort of helped with the roads specifically. But they've got to come up with some sort of fundamental restructuring, or else they're going there. And you know, the governor for a long time pinned his hopes on this internet sales tax collection.
Sure.
And we saw that, you know, Amazon and other companies have been paying that, and it hasn't really made the difference that they had hoped it would make.
Not the windfall they were expecting. You just said something that kind of struck me, which is that, you know, the money that's from the sales tax that goes to education, mm-hmm. That we've been, you know, drawing down on that. Aren't we one of the lowest, you know, per student states in the nation when it comes to paying for education? And then the question that I have is, what percentage of our, you know, overall budget is that education spending?
Well, yes, we're still last in the country in per pupil education spending. And when you point that out to legislative leaders who are talking about cutting income tax and cutting the money that goes to education, they say, well, we've put $1.8 billion into education since 2012. That's a huge infusion. We're going to continue to put money into education, maybe just a little less than we're going to be putting into, you know, we're going to take some of that and put it into other areas by reducing the income tax and moving it over to sales tax.
Well, and the Democrats in the legislature, super minority though they may be, they have other reasons for concern when talking about this tax cut. They say that this is exactly where the money ought to be going, is into things like education, or not that the billion dollar surplus is paying for the tax cut, but is that an accurate way of saying the Democrats' response to a proposed tax cut is, what about Medicaid? What about education?
Well, it kind of is. It kind of is paying for the tax cut, because you've got we've got $1 billion on the income tax side. We're going to cut $200 million or $225 million out of that. We're not really cutting it, because we're going to be raising the income or the sales tax. There's going to be a tax shift. Mm-hmm. So you're going to be taking money out of education and putting it in other areas, and reducing the overall tax revenue on top of that. Does that make sense? Sorry, I didn't explain that.
No, I think, well, it's taxes, so it's always difficult to get your mind around. But it just makes me think, you know, once again, how much would the state have to pay to fully expand Medicaid compared to this $225 million proposed tax cut?
And that's something that the advocates for the Medicaid expansion have pointed out, is we've got this surplus. We're talking about cutting taxes at the same time we're saying we don't have the money to fund Medicaid expansion. And Ben, I don't know. I haven't heard a very good answer from leadership about why they think that that's a good idea, how they sort of reconcile those two.
We've raised that question. I think they're still workshopping responses to that.
Okay. You know, the topic of taxes is difficult to follow, and I don't know. I mean, this is something that you think has a likelihood of passing, Robert, depending upon whether or not what the package is. We don't know what it's going to be.
I think there could be a tax cut. I don't think they're going to. The issue of fundamentally restructuring this and broadening that sales tax base that we were talking about,
right,
and taxing services gets into a very prickly area, because if you really want to tax services, if you really want to bring in some money from that, you go after doctors, you go after accountants, you go after lawyers. None of those are taxed right now. They're also some of the most powerful lobbies in the state. Mm. And so you start saying, we're going to take money from you. They're going to start saying, oh, no, you're not. Mm. And you're you're going to get a lot of pushback. And every one of these areas that isn't taxed right now has a powerful lobby. And that's part of the reason that they're not taxed, is because they've been able to resist that in the past. And also on top of that, you've got to look at all of these sales tax exemptions that we've had in the code that have been piling up for years and years and years, and see if they're still needed. Newspapers get a sales tax exemption. Is that still worthwhile? Maybe, maybe not. But you've got to start looking at all of these individually and looking at all of these different areas that are that you are or are not taxing and decide how you want to do it. And then there's nuance to all of those as well. And so it's an incredibly complicated situation. And I pointed out to a few people, like when Governor Huntsman passed an income tax cut during his first term, that was the culmination of a process that had begun 5 years earlier under Governor Walker. And income tax is really simple compared to sales tax. And so to try to rush this through in the matter of a few weeks and do it right and do it thoroughly is going to be a really big lift. Now, that said, I think you still could see a tax shift, a tax cut, you know, in terms of the sales tax. But I think in terms of fundamental restructuring, it's just too much for them to bite off.
Maybe a first step. 1 week down of the legislative session, 6 weeks more to go, unless the groundhog tells us differently on whatever day the ground tomorrow, I guess. Let's move to some other stories and bring finally into this conversation the Salt Lake Tribune public lands reporter Brian Maffley. And Brian, thanks for hanging out while we've been talking about taxes. I hope everybody else out there is still awake. you have first, let's get to some news out of San Juan County, and then maybe we'll circle back around to the legislative session. Can you actually, first, before we have this conversation, can you prove to me that you are really a Utahn? Do you have like a card that you can show me that says that you're a Utahn? I'm kidding.
I guess I have a driver's license and my kid's birth certificate.
This week, someone who had his status as a Utahn called into question got some good news. And Brian, what was that news?
Irony's pretty profound here. This challenge of Navajo candidate for San Juan County Commission has been going on for several months now, and it's kind of blown up on the San Juan County Republicans, who've been raising this issue for several months. And the latest iteration of this challenge to Willie Gray Eyes' resident status as a Utahn most recently came up with a court challenge by the gentleman Gray Eyes beat in the general election in November. His name's Kelly Laws. He's a well-known guy from Blanding.
Right.
Been there for, you know, like Willie, Gray Eyes has been in San Juan County for many generations. After 6 weeks after he lost the election, he files a lawsuit against Willie Gray Eyes, contending, hey, you live in Arizona, you're not eligible to hold office in San Juan County. So
is that,
it went to court last week. Yeah. Go on, Ryan.
No. I was just wondering if that's, I mean, is that just sour grapes? Is he saying?
Oh, I think that I think a lot of folks in Blanding may feel very strongly that Willie Gray Eyes lives in Arizona.
Okay.
But he lives in a part of San Juan County that is more connected to Arizona than Utah. It's not the Navajo Mountain chapter. It's on the state line, and Willie Gray's ancestry goes back to this place called Paiute Mesa. And to get to Paiute Mesa from Monticello, it takes 4.5 hours of driving, and most of which is through Arizona. Mm-hmm. And so, like many people in that area, Willie Gray Eyes has a post office box. He gets his mail in Arizona. He gets his driver's license in Arizona. He does all his grocery shopping in Arizona. And those facts have been used now against Willie Gray Eyes, but both by the county when they first kicked him off the ballot back in during the campaign. A federal judge, of course, reinstated Willie Gray Eyes' candidacy because the judge concluded that the county violated his rights in the way they handled that investigation. And so everyone was a little surprised that the losing candidate now resurrects this issue, and now a state judge, not a federal judge this time, actually, you know, ruled on on where actually Willie Gray Eyes lives, and by golly, he lives in Utah.
This final? Does that establish his bona fides? Is this final? Is Willie Gray Eyes now officially, you know, on the San Juan County Commission and doesn't have to?
Well, he was before. He was officially a resident of Utah before and on the county. He was sworn in. And why this is he's sworn in early January, and why this is significant is because now there is a Navajo majority on the three-member county commission in San Juan, which has historically been dominated by extremely conservative Republican folks, descendants of the Mormon pioneers, and so now you have descendants of the truly. Original inhabitants of that landscape. I mean, the irony here is Willie Gray Eyes' ancestry goes into this landscape long before San Juan County ever existed.
As a county, right? Yeah. And we've talked a lot about what Willie Gray Eyes, you know, getting on the San Juan County Commission and what a Navajo majority on the San Juan County Commission means for lands policy in that county. We've talked about on this show before. One big part of that, though, is that the county commission is now majority in favor of the Bears Ears National Monument.
Restoring
it to the
Absolutely.
Size that it had.
Well, of course, Willie Gray Eyes is the chairman of Utah Dene Bekea, which was the leading organization proposing the national monument that Barack Obama designated in 2016. His fellow commissioner, Kenneth Maryboy, is also a supporter of the monument. So now you have this complete reversal of the San Juan County Commission being anti-monument to now being pro-monument. It's going to be interesting now because San Juan County had previously filed papers with the courts to, you know, the monument reduction is now being litigated. Well, San Juan County is siding on the side of the Trump administration in those lawsuits. Well, are they going to now petition to be on the other side of that lawsuit now?
Right. What the local county commission wanted played heavily into the decision by the Interior Secretary to make this recommendation.
That's true. What you're saying is, the Secretary Ryan Zinke, when they recommended shrinking the monument by 80-90%, cited the desires of the San Juan County Commission at the time. Well, anyway, now we have a new commission that would not only want the monument restored, but put to the much larger boundaries that were originally proposed by Utah Dene Bekea, you know.
Robert Gerke, news columnist, I want to bring you in on this conversation. And, I mean, essentially what Brian Maffley's talking about is that things change. You know, you make a big decision to undo this declaration of a national monument, and then the San Juan County Commission changes drastically, part of that because of the way that a federal judge intervened in how voting happens in San Juan County. But I don't know. What do you think about these challenges to Willie Gray Eyes' residency and what the new commission means now?
I mean, if you take a step back, the whole thing is just bananas. The way that the entrenched power structure in San Juan County has fought this majority rule, which is what it comes down to, has been astonishing. Because you've got Wendy Black, who challenged Gray Eyes. Well, first, I guess, as Brian mentioned, you have the federal judge who ordered them to redistrict because they had refused to redistrict, and the districts that they had drawn had disenfranchised the Native population for decades. Then they're still fighting that. That's still in the Court of Appeals. You've got Wendy Black, who challenges Gray Eyes' candidacy. They kick him off the ballot. The judge puts him back on, saying you can't do that. To actually make that challenge happen, you have both Wendy and the county clerk falsifying documents under oath. I still think there's probably going to be criminal charges out of that, so stay tuned on that. The judge puts him back on. He wins the election. They challenge his candidacy. They're going to fight this tooth and nail every step of the way, and it just feels like there's an inevitability to the fact that the majority population in San Juan County is going to rule. And yes, times are changing, but they're changing to the direction of a representative democracy that should have been in place all along. And you know, I think Brian's point is dead on. You know, Kelly Laws was His family goes back generations. Willie's family goes back many, 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 many more generations than Kelly's does. And so, you know, it's an interesting political shift. But more than the politics, I think what's important about it is we're actually getting closer to a situation where the majority in that county has a say in how that county's run. Finally.
You know, Willie Gray Eyes took the seat on the county commission, if I'm not mistaken, previously held by Phil Lyman.
That's right.
Who is now in the Utah House of Representatives. Is that right? Or is he a senator?
Representative.
Thank you. Lyman, he got some fame or maybe notoriety, depending upon how you want to define it, for a protest ATV ride, an illegal protest ATV ride through a canyon that had been closed by federal land managers to protect sensitive archaeological sites. He was convicted for that. Now, as a state lawmaker, he's kind of revisiting the topic of roads that have been closed off. And Brian Maffley, can you tell us about Phil Lyman what he's doing at the legislature?
Yeah, of course. It's probably most people in Utah know that the thing that's made Phil almost a household name in our state is his involvement in that protest ride in Recapture Canyon in 2014. So the first bill he filed as a lawmaker on the opening day of the legislature was to create criminal penalties for people, for activists, or even federal land managers who block a county road, by putting rocks and digging trenches on it. But not only county roads, but also roads that the county will claim under that RS-2477 statute. And of course, those are in contention in federal court. And the upshot of that is he doesn't want the members of the public or the federal land managers to go and obstruct the vehicle access to those routes. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times they're pretty obscure, two tracks. The environmental community says, you know, most of them start nowhere and they go nowhere. They don't serve much of a purpose. Folks in San Juan County, like Phil, have a different perspective on that. They argue that, no, they're important conduits through the land.
So if the BLM or a BLM official went and roped off the county, it was an RS-2477. This is a claim under Mining Act, right? Is that correct?
It's an element of 19th century mining law.
Okay.
Yeah.
So if they went and blocked that off because they had some, you know, requirement to do something with the land or to protect the land, that would be illegal under state law if this passes.
Well, it actually is already illegal under state law. What this law would do would create criminal sanctions, a Class C misdemeanor,
okay,
basically up to 30 days in jail. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
For a federal employee, maybe. I mean, or whoever, or members of the environmental community.
I think that's my reading of it. So to justify this, these penalties, Phil has talked about how environmental activists or site stewards, the volunteers who go out and look after archaeological sites in San Juan County, there's quite a few people who do that, are illegally blocking roads. That was the allegation he made, and he described a particular incident to my colleague Bethany Rogers about that involved a group called Friends of Cedar Mesa, who were retiring some roads that led to archaeological sites in Butler Wash, and he characterized it as kind of a mischievous criminal gesture, and the executive director of Friends of Cedar Mesa completely rejects that assertion. They were actually working under BLM authority to retire these roads, and one of the roads that got retired was still on the travel plan, so it actually shouldn't have been. But that wasn't a mistake on Friends of Cedar Mesa's part. It was more of a mistake by BLM. But that said, the BLM is cutting a new road to these sites, so these roads, in Josh Ewing's telling, he's the director of Friends of Cedar Mesa, these roads don't even matter anymore. They're you can barely see them on the ground anyway, but they're being replaced by a more direct route.
And this is all of the claims over RS-2477, that's something that is wrapped up in litigation as well, correct? There's a lot of legal battles going on over that?
Yeah, and those disputes have a lot to do with who gets to control the land more than anything else. Mm-hmm. The counties want to assert these rights of way as a way to kind of, you know, maintain control over how that land is used. Mm-hmm. And the federal government is been pushing back, and it's tied up in federal court there's probably 20 different lawsuits pending, they've been going on for years now with no resolution in sight. Yeah. Yeah,
decades even. I was going to say, but just quickly, what does Bureau of Land Management say about the proposal from Lyman to make these to sort of intensify what the the penalty would be for closing off?
The federal agencies, both the Forest Service and the BLM, kind of shy away from challenging Utah lawmakers when it comes to these kind of proposals. They just don't want, you know, it's a losing proposition for them to speak out on it. And so in this case, they did. I did contact the BLM to see if this was a problem for them, that activists would be blocking roads. And they said, no, not really. But they weren't able to talk to me about the Friends of Cedar Mesa case because it's a matter that's under investigation and they don't like to discuss ongoing investigations.
But Brian, were they concerned at all about the potential for their employees to be arrested if they were out closing the county perceives as a road?
Yeah, they wouldn't tell me that one way or the other, but we know that in the fairly recent past, the San Juan County Sheriff, or former sheriff now, Rick Eldridge, has confronted BLM employees who have blocked roads that were supposed to be retired under a travel plan, but someone complained because it was a road they like to use. And it's resulted in, so this issue has resulted in a lot of tension between the BLM and local residents, especially in Blanding. Hmm.
And that's where I see this could become a problem the definition of a road is going to be left to the county sheriff and the county attorney to decide whether or not that this road should be or should not be closed.
Yeah.
And then so you're going to end up with BLM employees, activists, that sort of thing, who could be, you know, doing something that they, you know, is it a road? Is it not a road?
Well,
ultimately, it'll be up to the judge. But after charges are filed, it can open a can of worms.
You know, who else could get implicated here are private landowners, because it's quite common for a road that a particular county has an RS-2477 claim on passes through some private property. Well, what if that property owner decides, hey, I want to gate this property, this spot, and lock it? Well, you're obstructing the road that the county is claiming a right to. Well, you can get in trouble yourself now as a private property owner.
Hmm. Both of you, I'm going to have to cut you off for just a moment because we need to head to another break on the show. And when we come back, we'll try and squeeze in one more story before we head to our underplayed stories of the week. You are listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW. For more episodes of all our in-house podcasts, click on the Local Programs tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to KCPW to support public radio in your community.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW Public Radio, joined this hour by the Salt Lake Tribune's Brian Maffley, Benjamin Wood, and Robert Gerke. This is our Friday morning news roundup, and you can join us with your questions and comments by calling 801-355-8255. Brian Maffley, before the break, we were talking about San Juan County, Phil Lyman. I want to turn now just quickly, because we don't have very much time left in the show, to the topic of water at the legislature. You wrote about some legislative proposals that are in the works to investigate or to look into ways to combat the drying up West and how Utah is going to deal with water in the future. Can you talk about those proposals?
Sure. Yeah. Well, first of all, if you want to look at what's really at stake here, just go look at Lake Powell. You know, it's shriveling up and at its lowest point in years and with no end in sight, really.
This is fed by the Colorado River.
Colorado and the Green. Yeah. And And Utah, famously or infamously, is one of the largest per capita water users in the country. I think we're the second, even though we're in this extremely dry state, and a lot of our water is used to grow low-value crops. But that said, it's, the state of Utah still has not used its full share of the Colorado River. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's kind of held back on our conservation programs. But anyway, there are now some proposals to being floated to kind of explore ways for Utah to use less water, one of which is called water banking, which will bring some flexibility into how Western water law is administered in our state. So because of the way water law works, if you're not using water, you run the risk of losing the right to use it. And that kind of encourages and promotes overuse of the water. So this idea of water banking is to give agricultural growers the opportunity to not use the amount of water they've historically been using and banking it, quote unquote, downstream somewhere where it can be used to support, riparian habitats and the lake level of Lake Powell or Lake Mead. And then other folks won't be able to jump in and grab that water.
It's simply that the amount of water that you are allotted doesn't go away when you let it pass by.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's something that the legislature is considering. Or explain this proposal.
It's very difficult to just be able to predict how such a system would work and how you would administer it. And so there is a bill that Janie Iwamoto sponsored in the Senate. It's more of a resolution to kind of give this a comprehensive study. Mm. It would to really make the water banking fly, you'd have to change water law. And it would help if the other neighboring states would do similar things as well. So the idea is we'll set up a few pilot projects, which are already underway on a couple of the rivers in Utah, to see, how would you compensate the growers? How would you keep track of give them credit for the water they're not using and keep track of it once it's not used? And the big difficulty here is once someone's not using water, a junior water right holder can come and say, look, if that guy's not using the water who has a senior right, I want to use it. And so how do you be fair to that person who has that junior water right? It's very complicated. It's not an easy fix at all. In fact, there are no easy solutions to our disappearing water resources. This is just one of many, but it's one that's getting a lot of attention now.
And there are other proposals that are in the state legislature. You can check out Brian Maffley's article on this at sltrib.com. Yeah. We need to turn to our underplayed stories of the week, but just, Brian, while I've got you for one second,
yeah.
Is there big movement afoot at the legislature on Lake Powell Pipeline or Bear River Diversion this year?
No, and not legislatively. The Lake Powell Pipeline is in the permitting phase before the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission.
Right.
But legislatively, I'm not seeing much out there.
Okay. We need to turn now to our final segment of the show because we are at that point in time. And this is where we turn to our underplayed stories of the week, stories that maybe didn't get a lot of – we didn't highlight on the show. Brian Maffley, do you have a pick for underplayed story?
Well, yeah. This story was so underplayed, it barely appeared in our paper. But a couple days ago, some Democratic members of Congress proposed a bill that would restore the Bears Ears National Monument but go much farther to create establish a monument that's in line with the 1.9 million acres in San Juan County that the five tribes proposed. And it's was unveiled on Wednesday, and it probably won't do very well, but Utah's John Curtis, or Representative John Curtis, whose district Bears Ears is in, is already pretty upset with it because these Democrats didn't consult with him first, and he's got his own legislation out there to basically codify what President Trump did in reducing the monument to its now current size of 185,000 acres, give or take, It's 200,000 acres in two separate units.
Okay.
So,
all right. So, well, sort of competing measures there. Interesting pick for underplayed story. Benjamin Wood, what is your pick for underplayed story of the week?
I'm going to selfishly promote one of my own. So there's a bill that got out of committee this week that would legalize electronic driver's licenses. It gives the driver's license divisions 2 years to figure out exactly how to do that, what form that would be. But if this bill were to pass and if all were to go well, then we could leave our wallets at home in 2021.
We could. You could also still get a physical license, though, I take it?
Yeah, you would still have your physical license for, TSA and getting on an airplane.
Okay.
But for driving around, you could just show, if you're pulled over, you could show your smartphone.
Okay. Interesting pick. Definitely one to watch. Mm-hmm. And Robert Kirke, your pick for underplayed story.
Well, we had talked about having this one on the show, but I got long-winded. So I'm going to plug the hate crimes legislation that last Friday, a week ago, the church issued a statement saying they're not opposed to hate crimes legislation this session. It's kind of removed a big block that had been standing in the way of this legislation for the last several years. This week, it was scheduled for a hearing on Monday. It's not going to be in committee on Monday, but it will probably be in committee sometime next week because they're trying to work out some slight revisions to it that leadership wants. And so it looks like there's a possibility, at least, that we should get a hearing. Probably will pass the committee, should pass the Senate, so we'll see what happens in the House.
In the House, whether or not it can get through there. But a stronger chance than for quite a few years now.
A much, much stronger chance. In 2016, it got a 17 to 12 vote in the Senate, but then died after that because after the church had expressed reservations about it. This shift by the church seems to have cleared out that blockage.
Okay. I'm going to forego my pick for underplayed story of the week just in the interest of time. But listeners, you can check out all of the stories we've been talking about on the program today at sltrib.com. Robert Gerke, Benjamin Wood, and Brian Maffley, all with the Salt Lake Tribune, thanks very much for being here today.
Thank you.
Cool.
Thank
you.
You can find podcasts of this program at kcpw.org. Behind the Headlines is a co-production of KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune and is heard across the state on Utah Public Radio. Thanks to Jesse Ellis and to news intern Sarah Sadikon here at KCPW and to the team at Utah Public Radio in Logan for their help. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks for listening. We'll see you again next week.